Welcome to Statewide Reports and Conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. I'm Sean Crawford. This hour, we talk with an expert on conspiracy theories. Why do people believe such extreme ideas? And what can you do to respond? We'll discuss the situation in Venezuela. What is the U.S. goal there? And what are some obstacles? Agriculture is facing some serious headwinds. We'll have a report on how farmers in Illinois are faring. A county that has one of the worst shortages of skilled nursing beds in the state is trying to address that problem. We'll also get an update on the Illinois prison system's healthcare provider and concerns about the level of care being offered. The number of wetlands is on the decline. We'll head out to a preservation project to learn more. And it's a stressful time for international students. We'll talk with some of them. That and more coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. University of Missouri sociologist Chris Connor has studied and written about conspiracy theories for years. He says belief in them is spreading beyond the traditional fringe groups, maybe to your friends and family. And Kniggendorf spoke with him about why so many people are consuming even the most extreme-sounding ideas and how to respond.
What's an example of a conspiracy theory someone might casually bring up at a gathering?
So the one that keeps making the rounds is the kitty litter conspiracy theory.
I do not know that one.
So it's based on this idea that there's litter boxes in many elementary schools. And that's because of active shooters. And so there's been kitty litter in there in case they need to absorb vomit or if they need to have the kids use the restroom because they're often locked down for like 12 hours. So basically someone took this idea and said, oh, the kids must be identifying as cats.
Oh, well, that makes sense.
I mean, so it's the root of it is this anxiety or concern by conspiracists over people who identify as a different gender.
A whole lot of what conspiracy theories are concerned with is sort of a battle of good against evil, right?
Yeah, so we found with QAnon specifically that the believers in conspiracy theories see themselves as truth bearers walking in the light and that those who are opposed to them are some kind of dark, evil, satanic force.
Why does it seem like it's making it to more progressive spaces? And what's the danger of that?
These are old tropes that are based on xenophobia, racism, homophobia, and they are harmful because what they do is they kind of package these ideas in a new form. Hey, these are the people who are making your life miserable, whether that be trans people or people of color or Jewish people, right? Those people don't have power and are often the most marginalized. And that's when you end up with a rise in hate crimes and all kinds of things that we would not like to see in society, let's say.
Oh, somebody I know was recently talking about Alex Jones in this some kind of thing in California, like a something Grove.
Oh, Bohemian Grove. Oh, that's so interesting. So Bohemian Grove is a real place where a lot of these former presidents, heads of Fortune 500 companies go.
Like a retreat center?
And yeah, they do some crazy stuff with some rituals and whatnot. That's it.
Okay.
Do they conspire? Well, you know, I think all of us conspire. The difference is those people have actual power, right, to impact society. And that's the issue. And I think that leads people to some bizarre conclusions. People who believe these ideas, they've been harmed by the system. And so their beliefs are kind of justified in a sense.
You've mentioned the role of empathy when talking to somebody who is really mired down in one or more conspiracy theories.
So one of the things that sociology professes is this idea of radical empathy. That's what I'm kind of promoting, is this idea that love for others, right? And creating an off-ramp for people to basically come back into society. Because if we demonize people who have those beliefs and don't allow them for growth and change, then, you know, there's no hope.
Thank you very much for talking to me today.
Pleasure to be here.
Chris Connor is a University of Missouri sociologist who has studied and written about conspiracy theories for years. That story produced by KCUR in Kansas City. A new law that's now in effect will force police to start looking for missing people sooner and make them look longer. It says law enforcement cannot establish a waiting period before taking a missing person's report. The Democratic State Senator Michael Hastings of South Suburban Orland Hills sponsored the measure. During the debate last year, he also said police won't be able to close a case until they've exhausted every lead.
Law enforcement must keep missing person cases under active investigation until the person is located or returned.
Local and state agencies will be required to forward cases older than 60 days to the national database. That measure passed the Senate unanimously, but more than two dozen Republicans in the House voted against it. In the U.S. today, more than 1 million visa students are studying on college campuses. They're facing a reality much different from their domestic peers. The NPR Illinois J-Corps community reporter Kou Hopkins heard from some of the students who came to this country for an education but are having to balance school with political reality.
Arushe Avon is a senior at Bradley University studying political science. She's an international student from Pakistan on the pre-law track, hoping to attend law school after graduation. Like many in college, she's dealing with finances.
I work two jobs on campus so I can support myself and not be a burden on my parents.
But making ends meet is just one of the things on her mind.
Then there's also the idea of legality. Am I working on time? Am I going over time? Do I also keep my grades up? Because it also affects my scholarship. But people don't understand this stuff. They think that just because you're in the country, you're good now.
She is also paying attention to the Trump administration's approach on immigration. Many students I contacted declined to talk with me due to the fear that speaking out could have consequences for their visa status. Arushe understands and says she mostly stays quiet about such issues.
There are so many times where I have to stay mute. Because if I answer a different thing or a question a different topic, it would affect me and my visa, and I would really want to get my degree because it's a hard thing being a student.
It all leads to more stress for a young college student. According to the National Institute of Health, international students in the U.S. face significant mental health challenges with high rates of anxiety and depression, driven by factors like cultural adjustment, isolation, language barriers, and financial need. While she made a voluntary decision to come to this country, others have had that decision forced upon them. Ignat Strelitsky from Ukraine is a student at the University of Illinois Springfield. He is passionate about law, political leadership, and international relations as he hopes to continue his work in political campaigns and community engagement. At the age of 17, he and his mother boarded an evacuation train from the war-torn homeland.
On March 9th, we went to the railway station and we jumped to this evacuation train, where it was kids from Mariupol, from southern part of Ukraine, from Donetsk region, who tried to just to leave the war zone, just try to escape this tragedy. So if you imagine there was like one seat and I split this one seat with two or three people, it was baby crying, it was no food, no bathrooms.
From there, he walked the last leg of his journey on foot from the Polish border and got to France. He soon found himself in the U.S.
The United States is the land of the opportunity for all. And I think that as a kid, I wanted to make a difference. I wanted to make an impact. Later on, when I was around 15, 14, I found myself in a position that I wanted to be a lawyer. Possibly a politician, because in my opinion, that was the way that I can serve my country, serve my people, and make an impact.
Ignat is still hopeful and appreciative of this kindness that he has received. Walter Hernandez is an international student now in Tennessee. He is studying business administration and is a young entrepreneur operating his own business based in Mexico. He touches on how coming to the U.S. has changed his life and his business, as he works with artists worldwide with intellectual property. Although, while excited for the opportunity, he still misses home.
It is a different experience than the one that other students are having. In fact, leaving your home behind, it's one of the things that makes us regret even coming here.
Another point that causes this type of regret is stereotypes. Walter touches upon how these stereotypes are born from ignorance and misconceptions.
I addressed many racist comments in this sense. I am a proud Mexican, and I will act the best I can now that I'm here in the USA, because I am an ambassador of my country. And every time I'm here, I try my best to do academically and health-wise, and for other people to notice that I am not the stereotypical Mexican, but someone else.
An analysis from the Institute of International Education shows new international student enrollment at the U.S. campuses fell 17% this fall because of visa restrictions and other government policies. Those students pay tuition and spend money. This drop is projected to cost the U.S. economy more than $1 billion. Walter says there are other costs not always measured financially.
So I think immigration really brings so many new opportunities for everyone. I am here not to get help by the university to get money, but I'm truly just here to share what I know.
I'm Ko'u Hopkins, reporting for the NPR Illinois J-Corps, funded with the Healing Illinois Grant from the Field Foundation and the Community Foundation for the Land of Lincoln's Press Forward Illinois Initiative.
The Illinois Association of Behavioral Health is teaming up with school sports organizations for a program combating youth substance misuse. The association's Ashley Webb told the reporter Braden Fogerson that Generation Lead is in its second year as a program.
We go into schools, we have printed material, we have digital material like commercials, posters, talking kits, bookmarks. Anything to raise awareness about substance use and also how to include recovery and services for anyone that's in need. And so new this year for our second year, we decided to partner with the IHSA and IESA. We knew that we needed to reach an audience that wasn't always, you know, just going into schools and hoping that we would be able to talk to a health class or just do a presentation. And the IHSA and IESA have been instrumental in their partnership and collaborating with sports and substance use prevention and leadership. It just made sense. And so we're thrilled to have that partnership.
What can this do for student athletes?
Our goal is just to, you know, captivate an audience to let them know that being a leader is okay. Being substance free is okay. And taking that positive message and hopefully, you know, sprinkling that through their peers. And so our hope is also that student athletes and their teams will see our campaign and say, we want to bring that to our community. We want to raise awareness about substance use prevention, mental well-being, and recovery resources, and bring their campaign to their school.
What sort of leveling up does this do for both parties? IHSA already had, you know, policies against substance misuse, but what does Generation Lead do to further that effort?
Yeah, it provides tangible resources is what Generation Lead does. So, you know, they have their policies and that's wonderful and we fully support that, but it's getting that messaging out in the schools and the community to parents and those resources with our talking kids, and also having the digital component of it too. We know youth are on social media, so making sure that they're seeing those advertisements and listening when they're listening to Spotify, we have our ads playing on there. So we're targeting those communities and making sure that it's just not something that they're hearing, you know, at school or in their, you know, meetings that you need to live substance free, but also seeing it and connecting it. So it's the tangible resources.
Still here with Ashley Webb of the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health. Ashley, how do we know that there's progress? You know, do you get, you know, parents talking or coaches, students themselves?
Being in the second year, we're measuring the impact and doing it, evaluation all the time, as you can imagine. We have on our website the ability to request free material. So we are getting material requests every day, every week. Our staff are constantly going throughout the state and delivering the material, hanging up the material. We have heard from many preventionists, school teachers, social workers, guidance counselors, coaches about how they've seen our material and how they want our campaign in their community. So, you know, we track on the end, on our end, where they're getting this information and how many reaches our commercials and radio ads are reaching. But the biggest thing is how many people are requesting our material to get into their communities. And right now we're statewide.
So Illinois is a very big state. There's, you know, Southern Illinois, there's Central Illinois with all the corn and everything. And then you've got the Chicago area. I wondered if there's anything different about the different areas of Illinois that kind of leads to a different approach in this.
Of course, that is one of our biggest things is the state of Illinois is really diverse. And so from rural communities to urban and suburban, we have to make sure that we're tweaking our messaging and our outreach in those ways. And one thing that I'm really proud of is every one of our programs, including Generation Lead, have youth advocates. So a board of youth who sit on and represent their communities, their districts, and share the messaging that they think works. You know, we as professionals, we think we know what students want, but we're really proud that we have a group of students for every program that really share what they are connecting with and what resources they want and what they want to see from, you know, from Generation Lead from start to finish. It was the colors, the fonts, the, you know, the language, the tagline. They were part of every focus group and every from start to finish of how we created this campaign. That's why our tagline is our voice, our future, because it's really tailored for the youth by the youth. We even have our material in different languages. So we have Polish and Spanish right now, and they're available on our website as well.
Ashley Webb is Vice President of Programs at the Illinois Association for Behavioral Health. She spoke with Braden Fokerson. More to come on Statewide. We'll return in a moment. We're back on Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. There are some big warning signs in agriculture right now. Many experts are warning an aid package announced by the Trump administration is not likely to go very far or come soon enough. Charlie Schlinker reports.
A lot of farmers are underwater in spite of a bumper crop, if they can even find someone to sell to.
I'm scared that we're rivaling a scenario like we saw in the 80s for agriculture.
Illinois Agriculture Director Jerry Costello says the stress farmers are seeing is enormous. He says Illinois farmers are averaging 30 cents a bushel loss on corn and $1 a bushel on soybeans. That adds up. Ag economists are estimating U.S. farmer losses at between $35 and $43 billion. Costello blames mostly the president's tariff policies.
It's beyond logic where we are in the trade wars that we're having with so many different countries.
Costello says he could have understood strategic limited tariffs as a tool to get to an agreement, but not this.
It's scary as hell to think about where we're at and how widespread this is.
For perspective, Costello says, Illinois has around $8.7 billion in agricultural exports per year. 80% of that goes to Canada, Mexico, and China, all places on which the federal administration has imposed tariffs.
And that's not adding everything in. I mean, you can't talk about affordable housing and be in a trade war with Canada, you know, which is a huge lumber producer and supplier for the U.S.
It's not just tariffs hitting the ag sector. Here's Illinois Farm Bureau President Philip Nelson.
We've got the same prices if you adjust to inflation as we had in 1974, but our input costs have quadrupled in that same time period.
Nelson says the only input price that has gone down is the cost of diesel fuel.
You got four seed companies that control about 80% of the seed market. You got four meat packers that control over 80% of the meat packing capacity. And you got about four fertilizer companies that do about 80% of the business worldwide.
Nelson says he's pleased Congress is looking at the lack of functional markets on inputs.
To have better transparency in those markets so that they work and they don't just get set by the big four, you know, take it or leave it.
Farm Bureau President Philip Nelson and Ag Director Jerry Costello agree interest rates are still high as well. And as the old Pete Seeger song goes, farmers need a functional bridge until they can sell the crop.
Oh, the farmer is the man, the farmer is the man, lives on credit till the fall. Then they take him by the hand and they lead him from the land, and the middleman's the one who gets it all.
Catherine Bertini is a former Assistant Secretary of Agriculture and is now a Distinguished Fellow of Global Food and Agriculture at the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. Bertini says farmers are increasingly having to shop around.
It's hard to find a bank sometimes that will want to lend to agriculture interests.
Bertini says the present crunch is mostly caused by tariff policies, yet farmers have always been subject to cycles.
And then all of a sudden, boom, markets got pulled out from under them. So what do they do?
In the past, sometimes crops were sent abroad. That's the rationale behind the World Food Program, to deal with surpluses.
But the U.S. administration isn't doing much overseas, but that could be an avenue for at least some, but it's obviously not one that is explored and not fast enough for those crops not to spoil.
What the U.S. administration has done is propose $12 billion in aid, most of it for corn and soybean farmers. First, there's a question about the timeliness of that. Bertini says the administration has yet to put out details on how farmers apply and get the money. Then the money is supposed to be available by the end of February.
So that's still quite a delay for guys and women that owe money for various reasons and didn't get to sell their crops.
It may not be a matter of will, but of logistics and paperwork processing. But Illinois Farm Bureau President Philip Nelson says he hopes it doesn't take that long. He says moving that up by even a month would help. Who will get the money and how much? That's not entirely certain yet. There will be hoops people have to jump through to get it. The administration is quoted by some media outlets saying the most an individual person or legal entity could receive will be $155,000. Only producers with an adjusted gross income of less than $900,000 will be eligible. Illinois Agriculture Director Jerry Costello says that $12 billion in aid is like putting a Band-Aid on a heart attack. Farm Bureau President Philip Nelson simply calls it a Band-Aid. Jerry Costello says the projected losses to the ag sector from the tariffs are exponentially higher than the economic pain caused by tariffs against China and Chinese retaliation during President Trump's first term. Yet the aid is less than half the money allotted the first go-round. Costello says Illinois soybean sales to China had not even recovered from the first round of tariffs 7 years ago. The University of Illinois reports farm bankruptcies ticked up 55% last year in the U.S., ending a four-year downward trend. There were just four in Illinois. Costello says you should expect more.
A couple of years ago, we had some very, very good years in agriculture, but farmers are through their reserves, and I think it's really going to start hitting, unfortunately, right about now and over the next year.
And Catherine Bertini says it's not just farmers, it's the whole ag sector that's hurting.
Both Caterpillar and John Deere, the two big American makers of farm equipment, have complained to the administration, or raised to the administration their concerns because these tariffs and export policies and so forth are impacting them also. And they're also asking for some financial relief.
Illinois Farm Bureau President Philip Nelson says more than aid or credit or anything else, farmers will have to look at their bottom lines.
And maybe you can tweak it on fertilizer, chemicals, that sort of thing, because those are big inputs. But I think at the end of the day, we hope that some of these markets will start opening up and it will be reflected in the prices and improve the bottom line.
Nelson says you have to give President Trump's trade policies a chance, but the administration can't let it go on a couple years. State Ag Director Jerry Costello asks, why should the administration policies be expected to work now when China hasn't lived up to previous agreements? Costello equates the farming crisis to arson.
Charlie Schlinker with that report. Well, certainly the eyes of the world have been on Venezuela after the U.S. sent troops to that country to capture the president, Nicolas Maduro. Roy Worley, former State Department official who served as head of economic policy for the U.S. in Vietnam, joins us to talk about it. He's also a professor emeritus from the University of Illinois Springfield in the economics and environmental departments. What is most important about the U.S. taking over Venezuela and getting rid of this person who, by all accounts, a despicable dictator?
Well, I would say the first thing is it's obviously clear that Maduro is a rascal and a terrible leader of the country in terms of the way he runs it. There's no question about that. And there are many people in Venezuela today that are very happy that he's gone. There's no question about that. But the larger question is, what message does that send to the world? And to me, I would answer by saying it confirms that we're in a new era of the world, that we've been in it for a while. Russia started it. All this came about when they broke the rule of the UN Charter that thou shalt not change borders by force. And we have now confirmed that we are part of that new nationalism, which I sometimes call cutthroat nationalism, because it's unguided, it follows no rules. In fact, it follows what the administration mentioned the other day. They were quoting Thucydides during the Peloponnesian Wars when he said, the strong do what they want and the weak suffer what they must. I would say that's the biggest thing that comes out of this, that we confirm that that's where we are now.
You mentioned the new nationalism. Why do you view that as so important?
Well, the new nationalism is very important because for the last 70 years or so, the U.S. led a nationalism that was rules-based, and I mentioned the rule just a second ago, and that was abided by around the world. There was no fight between the great powers, and the nationalism was umpired by the United States, more or less, sometimes good, sometimes bad. But there was a leadership, there was an enforcement of the open sea lanes, there was prosperity during those 70 years, unlike the world's never seen, because of a nationalism that was managed in terms of rules and good behavior so the weak did not have to suffer what they most must.
This U.S. action, is this a violation of international law?
Oh, there's no question it's a violation of international law. You can't even find words to work around and make a game out of it, because the U.N. Charter makes this very clear. The sovereignty of a nation is what is going to be our world in the future, not what the powers can do what they want. So this is clearly breaks both the norms of the world that were established and breaks the UN Charter and international law.
So why did the president, you believe, take this action at this time?
That's not as simple as a lot of people say, I think. A lot of people say we took it because he wanted to get the oil. Yes, he does want to get the oil. A lot of people said it because he wants to show off his power. And I would say that in his press conference, he really disclosed that his ability to push buttons of power is very pleasant to him. He talked about we're going to run Venezuela 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 times. So that shows that he really wanted to show the power of the United States in doing this. He wanted to create some fear in the Western Hemisphere, that they better abide by his wishes or they'll get what Venezuela got. So there's a lot of pieces in it. And I think that the fact that he put Rodriguez, the new vice president, as his main person there shows that he's not so concerned about the people as such or of regime change, it's leadership change.
I'm hearing a lot of different words thrown out by people when it comes to regime change, so you don't believe that's what's happening?
No, it's not regime change. Machado, who got the Nobel Prize, is, everybody says in Venezuela that she is the one that the people there support. She's the opposition to Maduro before all this happened. And she was thrown off the ballot by Maduro. and has shown great heroism in going against him in that particular regime. So if the president wanted to get the people's backing for what he's doing, and that's not an easy thing to do, he would back her and let her start building up a support for elections in which she would be in all likelihood elected. But he didn't do that. And the reasons he didn't make some sense. If you think of what happened in Iraq for the United States, when we went in with troops on the ground, or other places I could mention, we could even, Sean, go back to Veracruz in 1914. President Wilson was convinced that he had to send troops into Mexico to get rid of their hated dictator, the Mexican people, and they would all come and join him. Well, once the troops hit the ground, the people in Mexico decided they hated the Yankees and their imperialism more than they did the dictator. And they fought the Americans, and we lost a lot of troops under General Scott.
I think that's a big concern right now among a lot of people, is that are we getting ourselves into some foreign conflict, troops on the ground? That, so far, is not what the president has said.
That's exactly right. He has not said that, and he's avoided that. And that's why he's backing the existing, and it's called the Chavista regime in Venezuela, and that means it goes back to Hugo Chavez. And that's been a very harsh dictatorial regime. Many, many people in prison, tortured, et cetera, et cetera. Those are the boots on the ground. They're running it. Now, Trump is smart in the sense that he doesn't want to get involved in putting our troops down there and seeing what happens if that takes place. So he has chosen not to support Machado, but rather to support Rodriguez, which the Supreme Court put into power. So Trump has got, he's made a change at the top, but he relies on the whole bureaucracy that was under Maduro that want to keep their jobs and that will support their way and their interest. And how will Trump force them to be his lackeys? That's the question, I think.
And that's the big problem with trying to run it from D.C., run Venezuela
that's
from
right.
D.C. Is that the only problem that the U.S. has there?
It probably, he would be happy if it was. But no, that's a really good question, because it's not the only obstacle. The trafficking and drug cartel in Venezuela has deep roots into that country, and they have lots of money, and they're not going to let go of these things. So that's an obstacle right there to get Venezuela to cry uncle, we'll do whatever you want. The second big obstacle, besides the one that I just mentioned, namely the old regime, the Chavistas who are still running it, is that the China-led axis of Iran and Russia and Cuba, led by China, they put a lot of money, effort, and hope into Venezuela. In fact, Fiona Hill told the Congress just about a couple of years ago that the Russians, during the first term of Trump, offered to let the United States take over Venezuela and do whatever they want if the United States would agree that they could do whatever they want into the Ukraine. And Fiona Hill herself was the person that was sent over to Russia to say, no, we would not do that. So that gives you a little bit of a sense of what that is now. And will these four countries look at this and say, look at where the Trump is weak. Look at where's their fragility and what he's done. And they will exploit those and try to get it into a kind of a Vietnam-like morass that we had so long before, a long war, which is his MAGA supporters have always said that's the last thing they want him to do. So I think all those are obstacles, Sean, and how he's going to run it from D.C. One of the ways is just to tell Rubio, you go do it. Well, that may not work.
Roy Worley is a former State Department official and professor emeritus at the University of Illinois Springfield, and he spoke with me about the situation in Venezuela. Coming up on Statewide, what one Illinois county is doing to try to meet the need for skilled nursing. You're listening to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Skilled nursing facilities provide a place for people to recover after they've been hospitalized for an illness, surgery, or injury. Champaign County has one of the worst shortages of skilled nursing beds in the state. Alyssa Eaton reports on why Champaign is an outlier and what the county's doing to try to address the problem.
Jan Sherbert is a resident of Urbana. She and her husband were married over 40 years and have three daughters. In 2020, Sherbert's husband had a severe stroke and ended up needing skilled nursing care because he was paralyzed and unresponsive. After he was discharged from the hospital, he was sent to a facility an hour away because it was the closest bed available.
I had to drive an hour every day in the winter to see him. It was an hour there and an hour back. And of course, for all those people who've gone through these, you are emotional going, and you're even more emotional coming home. Every day I'd come home and I would just collapse in a heap.
Sherbert eventually decided to bring her husband home.
This was like maybe not even a week that I could put up with it. And if I cry, it's because I always do.
She went online to find information about how to take care of him. She says he was in bad shape and had lost about 40 pounds. After a year of home hospice care, Sherbert's husband died. Stories like hers aren't uncommon in Champaign County, which is dealing with a shortage of about 300 skilled nursing beds. These beds are often housed inside of nursing homes. Since 2019, three facilities that offer skilled nursing care have closed down. And it turns out, nursing home closures happen all the time in the industry, in part because they cost a lot of money to run.
So the whole focus is profit, and that's the problem.
That's Naoko Marumatsu, a professor of community health at the University of Illinois, Chicago.
Basically nationwide, there are private equity companies. They buy up lots of healthcare facilities, nursing homes, hospitals, many other things. They need to get profit and not to care for older people or people who need care.
Kathy Emanuel is the committee chair for Advocates for Aging Care, a grassroots organization in Champaign. One of their goals is to address the skilled nursing bed shortage. Emanuel says one reason these facilities tend to run out of money is they often rely on payments from Medicaid, the federal state health insurance program that covers low-income people, including elderly people who've run out of money due to long-term nursing home stays.
If you're there very long, you use up all your assets and you move to being Medicaid. In many cases in Illinois, the reimbursement for Medicaid is not even enough to cover the actual costs of providing that care.
Matt Newkirk says the skilled nursing shortage puts a strain on local hospitals. He's the director of home health and skilled nursing facilities at OSF Healthcare. When people can't be safely discharged after an injury or illness, Newkirk says they end up stuck at the hospital.
What we're running into now is the baby boomers that are getting to that age where they're going to start needing placement. Champaign County, you know, because there's not enough beds, it's just going to become a bigger and bigger and bigger issue for those hospitals in that area.
Emanuel says Advocates for Aging Care is working with the University of Illinois, Parkland, and Carle to get a new nursing home built in the county. They received a $500,000 grant from the state of Illinois for the project.
We have been talking to some potential developers who would come in and develop a facility here if we can bring the community together to support that effort. We think we might be able to have put together enough of an incentive package to attract somebody here.
She says they're hoping to break ground on the new facility next summer and have it open the following year. The goal is to have about 120 beds, so it wouldn't completely solve the shortage, but it would be a start. I'm Alyssa Eaton, IPM News.
Centurion Health is the healthcare provider for the Illinois prison system. A Chicago Sun-Times review of more than 100 lawsuits against the company shows a recurring pattern. People in prison repeatedly complain about a health issue, are ignored by correctional and medical staff, and their condition worsens to the point of dangerous complications or even death. Centurion took over the contract last summer. Reporter Caitlin Washburn sat down with the host of Prison Cast, Aaron Allen, to share what she found.
The new company that provides health care to nearly 30,000 people in Illinois state prisons has a disturbing track record. Centurion Health took over health care for the Illinois Department of Corrections this summer after a multi-year deal with a different company fell through. Centurion already serves close to a dozen other state correctional systems, where it's been accused of ignoring and misdiagnosing patients, leading to serious illness or even death. Chicago Sun-Times reporter Caitlin Washburn has been digging into lawsuits filed by incarcerated people. She sat down with the host of WBEZ's Prison Cast, Aaron Allen, to share what she found.
So you reviewed more than 100 lawsuits filed against Centurion Health in almost a dozen states where it currently or previously worked. Before we get into the specifics, what are some trends that you noticed?
Yeah, I learned a lot reading through these lawsuits. And while each case had its own complications and own devastating details, I learned about a recurring problem that seemed to happen over and over again. People incarcerated have a health condition. They complain about it. They say they're in pain. They're noticing something weird about their body. It's ignored. They're not taken to see a doctor, or if they are, there's no urgency in treating their health condition. And then it just gets worse, and it turns into complications that could have been avoided and deaths that were also preventable.
In all of the research you've been doing, is there a case that stands out to you as an example of what incarcerated people allege that they face when they're treated by Centurion?
Yeah, as you can imagine, there were a lot that will stick with me for a while, but one that is just particularly harrowing is a man in Vermont who was being held in a prison. He was actually detained before a trial, so he hadn't been convicted yet. But he had been there for a couple months, and he started to struggle to breathe. And he just was coughing a lot, and he went to see the doctor, which was Centurion staff at this prison. And they diagnosed him with COPD, which is a serious lung disease, and they gave him a nebulizer, which is what you use to treat something like that. Yet they never checked his airways, according to a lawsuit filed by his family. And his condition got worse. The nebulizer didn't seem to do anything. And he was finally taken to the prison infirmary. And according to the lawsuit filed by his family, a nurse told him to stop acting like a child as he was struggling to breathe. And he eventually passes out and doesn't wake up again. And according to the lawsuit from his family, the first people to ever check his airways are the medical examiners doing his autopsy, and they found a cancerous tumor pressing on his airway that suffocated him to death.
Wow, that is tragic. The previous healthcare provider for the Illinois Department of Corrections, Wexford Health Sources, also had a documented history of improper care. You talked to some advocates about this. What did they have to say about why the system is not working?
Yeah, so Centurion is not alone. As we know here in Illinois, Wexford has this long history of providing substandard care too. And the advocates I spoke to said, you know, Wexford, Centurion, this is a part of the business model. This isn't some fluke. This is something that is a part of these for-profit private companies and how they do business and how they provide health care. They get these lucrative contracts, and then advocates say they turn around and they do everything they can to line their own pockets and keep their margins fat while also denying people health care.
Did Centurion or the Illinois Department of Corrections respond to the reporting that you've done?
No, they did not. I sent multiple requests for comment and they have not been answered.
Okay. And I know that Centurion is on a temporary contract in Illinois right now. Do you have any sense of what's next? Are they going to provide health care here in the long term?
That is another big question mark here. They've extended the contract into January with no clear explanation as to what's next, if there's going to be another company or if it's going to be Centurion in the long run.
Chicago Sun-Times reporter Caitlin Washburn, she delved into dozens of lawsuits against the company in charge of health care in Illinois prisons and found patterns of people being ignored, sometimes resulting in dangerous complications or death. Illinois state lawmakers have signed off on legislation that would create sales tax and revenue bonds known as STAR bonds. And as Will Bauer reports, Governor Pritzker recently signed that legislation into law.
Some may know STAR bonds because the Kansas legislature has been using them to lure the Royals and Chiefs away from Missouri. Under this bill, they couldn't be used for a professional sports team in Illinois. But they can be used on massive projects, ones that will require a capital investment of $30 million, do at least $60 million in annual gross sales, and create 300 new jobs. Swansea Democrat Jay Hoffman sponsored the legislation.
Hopefully we'll have all three STAR bond projects in our region, creating, thousands of jobs.
Developers would be able to use the sales tax generated by the project to repay the government bond, which could be as much as $75 million. I'm Will Bauer.
Conservationists say wetlands provide many benefits, but the number of wetlands in the Midwest is shrinking. Rich Egger visited one wetland preservation project, and he has this story.
Chainsaws, backhoes, wood chippers, they're all busy on a seasonably chilly morning along the Mississippi River in Canton, Missouri. A couple dozen people are working away on a five-acre plot of land, removing invasive trees and planting native species. Their goal is to transform this wetland.
As opposed to just a pool of water that forms and anything could go in there, now we're going to try to change that.
This is Dan Kelly. He organized this workday. It's the first one he's put together since graduating in 2024 as a master naturalist through the Missouri Department of Conservation and the University of Missouri Extension. He says master naturalists do community-based projects such as roadside cleanups and bird counts. In this case, he wanted to modify this wetland, which is separated from the Mississippi River by the levee that protects this town. He says the site is a holding area for water, but it's turned itself into a natural wetland. And as this day progresses, Kelly finds their efforts transformative.
In that it really, really shows itself as being a wetland. Just from a casual observation, you can see it. Otherwise, you didn't really know it was here before when all the trees are here.
The crew also planted milkweed, which is native to Missouri and attracts pollinators. This kind of work is important, according to Randy Smith.
We don't have wetlands to spare anymore. And so those that are remaining are just critical to maintain.
Smith is a biologist and ecologist, and he's the Illinois River Project Director for the Nature Conservancy. He's involved with a couple major wetland restoration projects in West Central Illinois. Smith says wetlands are beneficial to a variety of animal and plant species. They're also valuable to humans because they purify drinking water, help prevent flooding, recharge groundwater aquifers, and provide recreational opportunities.
Just all sorts of valuable things, from getting outdoors and enjoying outdoor spaces to things that we really depend on, both economically and as a society.
But Smith says Midwestern wetlands, especially along big rivers, are highly altered, primarily by humans. That's led to the degradation of wetlands. Back in northeast Missouri, the workday is more than just the removal and planting of trees. Dan Kelly also led several presentations on related topics, which were held at the Canton Public Library. One of them featured Chris Schultz, an environmental compliance manager with the Missouri Department of Transportation. The department is conducting a study to determine hotspots for collisions between vehicles and wildlife, including species that might be migrating to a wetland. Schultz says one northeast Missouri hotspot appears to be between Wayland and Canton because of collisions between vehicles and some rare and unique animals.
Specifically, a couple of state endangered turtles that we've been aware of for many, many years. And we actually put up a turtle fence south of Wayland back in the late 2000s to keep turtles off the road up there.
MoDOT has a page on its website where people can report collisions for the study. Schultz says the department wants to make sure people are safe and they want to protect wildlife at the same time. Rich Egger reporting.
We're out of time for Statewide, but thanks for being with us. Join us again next week. We'll return with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois and the Midwest. You can find us where you get your podcasts, through the NPR app, and at nprillinois.org. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois, with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.